Hi, friend. You're listening to a London Lyceum exclusive episode that is typically only available to subscribers. If you want to have access to all of our exclusive content, including Kiffin's Keep, Generally Particular, Typology by Immersion, The Hanover House, and all of our live stream content, consider joining for just $5 a month. Not only will you be getting access to all of this content and more, but you'll also be supporting and investing in an institution serious about thinking. So why not go ahead and click the link in the description now and enjoy all of the exclusive content directly to your mobile device or wherever you listen. As always, we're thinking about new ways to get you thinking, and we appreciate your support. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Jake Stone.
I'm Jesse Owens.
We welcome you to another episode of Generally Particular, a production of the London Lyceum. Generally Particular is a show dedicated to discussing and reflecting on the whole Baptist story. We are a show by Baptist, about Baptist, and for Baptist, as well as Anglicans, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Lutherans. And even if by some odd chance this group is listening, and it's on my mind because I checked out a couple of resources for this denomination, if we had any Seventh-day Adventists listening today. I'm a Calvinist Baptist. Jesse is an Arminian Baptist. In the 17th and 18th centuries, we would have been known as a particular Baptist and a general Baptist. And so we brought those together in what we think is a fun way to talk about Baptist history, hence Generally Particular. Well, Jesse, first of all, as we're recording this, we're at the one-year mark of when we released our first show.
Wow.
Here we are.
We never anticipated it would go even this long.
My mom and dad believed in us. Hey. I guess Jordan Stefaniak believed in us.
Yeah.
It might have been the only people who believed in us.
Yeah.
But here we are, a little grayer, in Jesse's case, just no
a little
hair.
Balder.
But we've had a lot of fun, and we've been doing this series on Baptist bios. We're going to take a little bit of a break from that today, and we kind of just want to, I don't want to say go on a rant, you know, because that's a strong word, but we kind of just want to chew on some things today, and we're titling this episode, American or Baptist? Now, we love America, and I make no apologies for the United States of America being, I think, a wonderful place. I just finished a nice little biography of George Washington, and we were blessed that he was our first president. I think if you put anybody else in that position as the first president, even Adams or Jefferson, I don't know if the experiment works. And when I watch our current political leadership and think about George Washington, I would say we've fallen far from where we were. There's things in Baptist life going on that oftentimes I don't really think it's Baptist. I think it's more American. And what kind of got me thinking this way, me and Jesse were texting about some of this stuff. I read this little, you know, when you're someone like me, who's kind of a weird duck, you just read things for fun that nobody else would read for fun. So I read this book called Baptist Concepts of the Church, and it was edited by Winthrop Hudson. Fantastic name. I mean, we should just concede that off the bat here. But this was a collection. This was published by Judson Press in 1959. And this is a collection of essays that were originally addresses delivered among Northern Baptists. Now, by this time, they have changed their name to what it is now, the American Baptist Churches USA. But for the sake of our discussion, we're going to call them the Northern Baptists. And it was kind of exploring Baptist history and theology and ecclesiology. So there is a chapter on the Philadelphia tradition, you know, how the Philadelphia Association really impacted Baptist life in America, I would argue in a really positive way. There was a chapter on John Gill's ecclesiology, and it was written by someone that Jesse would have appreciated because the guy who wrote the article on John Gill didn't really care much for his theology. Of Calvinism, he says several times his rigid Calvinism. He'll say the hyper-Calvinist. You know, he doesn't even say John Gill's name. He just says the hyper-Calvinist. And then there's a chapter on Fuller, the Backus-Leland tradition. The Individualism of Francis Whalen, we could do a whole podcast on that, in that it was kind of depressing. If you want a catalyst for ecclesiology moving away from confessionalism, it's Francis Whalen in many ways. And then a chapter on landmarkism, which we all know how I feel about that.
And there was then, a lot of shouting and hallelujahs as you were reading that.
Yes. Well, the guy that wrote it was not very favorable to landmarkism, and some of his critiques were right. But again, I'll say this. A lot of what gets tagged as landmark today is really historic Baptist beliefs. I mean, it's really what it is. It's the landmarkers who have still taught those distinctives, frankly, when a lot of Baptists have stopped. And then the last chapter, which is really what kind of stirred my mind, was by Winthrop Hudson on shifting patterns of church order in the 20th century. And what he's getting at, and let's kind of use this as our launching point, Jesse, is as if we think about it, for example, as you move to the end of the 19th and end of the 20th century, Baptist polity begins to be defined by the term of pure democracy. You know, what it means to be a Baptist is that we follow pure democracy. But my question is that Baptist or is that American? Because if I go back to the Baptist confessions of the 17th century, if we looked at the first and second London, if we look at an Orthodox creed and Grantham's confession, and even the early confession of Thomas Helwes, and how those ideas come to America, they talk about how we're a covenant community. They talk about how we're knitted together. They talk about the way that churches relate to each other and a lot more of an interdependence than what you see as you move in the 20th century. So do you agree, Jesse, that when we talk, let me first ask this way, this notion of pure democracy, do you see that really in Baptist life at the start and how they defined ecclesiology, that kind of language?
Yeah. I don't think you see the language of pure democracy at all. And I think you're right to emphasize that sense of interdependence. So not only even within the life of a congregation, but even, you know, you mentioned earlier the Philadelphia Association, but the English General Baptist had this, and the Free Will Baptist, which I'm a part of in the U.S., have this even to this day. The very sense of associationalism and interdependency does mitigate against this sort of pure democracy. So no, I mean, I don't think the intent of early Baptists at all was to have a pure democracy in the sense of kind of a hyper individualist approach to church governance. No, it was kind of a mutual submission to one another, if anything else, not a kind of asserting our own way and having, like you said, as a pure democracy now.
Yeah, and I want to say something too. I know, you know, everybody that listens to us or watches knows that we have good friendly jabs with each other about our traditions. But I will say that I will tell anybody that I appreciate, one of the things I appreciate the most about Jesse's denomination, the Free Will Baptist in America, is the way that I think they have preserved very well what Baptist associationalism is supposed to be about. And I think that, you know, every other Baptist group in America would do well to learn from the National Free Will Baptist Association as far as how Baptist associationalism should still be working, not at a national level, but, you know, Jesse's talked to me many times about their local associations and things. And we've lost so much of that. And Southern Baptist life seems that way. Reformed Baptists have had a struggle with that in modern times. And so,
well, and again, if people are too concerned about following Arminian Baptists, the Philadelphia Association, I mean, yeah. It really, really, really similar model. You know, sometimes people accuse that model of being, you know, somehow dependent upon Presbyterianism and not being Baptistic. But I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, no. I think you see this sense of interdependency even in the 17th century. Quite a bit, and certainly even in the early 18th century into the mid 18th century among the Philadelphia Baptist Association in America, associationalism is extremely strong for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I would argue the Philadelphia tradition is more consistently biblical than the 17th century General Baptist practice, because y'all had that hankering for the bishop guy, which I know that Jesse likes. The messenger is what Jesse aspires to be. So that he
maybe we should have an episode on the office of messenger.
Jesse wants jurisdiction over the churches.
I'm not exactly sure it functions the way that you think, but
so that's what, one of the things I want to come back to, the Philadelphia tradition. But I want to read a little bit from Winthrop Hudson. And so what this episode is going to be is I'm going to read Winthrop Hudson, and Jesse will respond and tell us just off the top of his head what comes. And
I'm actually just here as a supporting cast member for this episode of Jake's Hot.
You're an integral part of this. In fact, you're carrying the show today.
All right.
So
go ahead.
So this statement, he's talking about the shift. Now, Grant Hudson's talking about Baptists in the North, but I think there's a lot of these things that make their way in the Baptists in the South as well. So he says this: the individualism of the frontier and of the Enlightenment, finding its most conspicuous political and cultural expression in Jeffersonian and Jacksonian democracy, had served to weaken the foundation of Baptist churchmanship. And the definition of the Christian life in purely individualistic terms by evangelicalism had permitted the crumbling of the foundation to be viewed with relative equanimity. So, for example, I don't know anybody that's using the terms like Baptist polity as democracy in this sense. It's kind of John Leland who coins that in some ways. And, you know, Leland is definitely, you know, Jeffersonian. And then as you move into the Jacksonian period, what do you think about that? Do you think that's a correct assessment, that as you're moving into the West through the 19th century, church life moves from corporate covenanted to individualistic?
Yeah, I mean, I think no doubt the influence of, you know, some of the philosophy of John Locke and the way that it finds its way into the American political experiment. No doubt that finds its way into the life of the church. I will say, in a very kind of practical, geographical sort of way, you know, as these churches are pushing out into the frontier, and by the frontier, we even mean places like North Carolina, quite frankly, as you push Kentucky. Across,
yeah,
even across places like the state of North Carolina and over into Kentucky and places like that. I mean, the frontier is not Oregon. It's like Kentucky. You know, you probably do lose a sense of associationalism, because you might only have a single Baptist church within a significant distance. And sometimes those churches might even be without pastors, again, because they're pressing further into the frontier. So I do think that there are probably historical political developments that play a part, like the development of certain ideas related to democracy in the American context. But then there's kind of also the geographic component as well. Whereas, you know, if you have a bunch of people gathered into an association in a metropolitan city, whether it's London or Charleston or wherever, that context is just different than as you're pushing across the state of North Carolina or the state of Kentucky. And I think that opens the door for all sorts of different types of developments throughout the 1700s and even into the 1800s that probably do maybe get off the path from what you would have seen in early Baptist life in places like Philadelphia, in Charleston, and other places. So I think there are all sorts of components that feed into those developments.
Let me ask you this question. I'm really going to put you on the spot here with this one. Do you think that in a way, the beauty of Baptist polity that made it easier for Baptists to plant churches also was one of its greatest obstacles in developing healthy ecclesiology? Because you've already mentioned not maybe an associational structure, not even a real pastor. And so in a sense, that's where I think it develops, where pastoral leadership will decline and deacons fill that void in a lot of Baptist churches as you push to the West. So what made it easier for us to plan a church as opposed to the Episcopalians or the Presbyterians? Do you think, though, that in some ways became a little bit of a hindrance for us?
Yeah, I mean, as far as a potential decline in polity, I think no doubt. You know, there's this strange reciprocal relationship between church polity and missions in some ways. You know, you kind of see it even with at the end of the 18th century, going into the beginning of the 19th century, with what we sometimes call the modern missions movement. And you think about that in light of Fuller's Gospel Worthy. And I don't know, you know, exactly how to trace it out, but there is this difficult relationship between pushing forward and planting churches and moving into new frontiers and missions, if we just want to call it missions, that sometimes does undermine church polity, because you think there's a necessity that we need to be flexible and have a certain level of elasticity in addressing a variety of needs as we push into new fields. But sometimes that desire to kind of justify any sort of change in order to take the gospel to the next place does erode polity over time. I mean, I think we've seen that in a variety of different contexts, whether we're thinking about in England or in the American colonies or in foreign fields too. You just see that again and again. And I don't know that we can always just put the blame in one place or the other, but it is something that we have to constantly keep in mind, that this reciprocal relationship between evangelism and missions and maintaining biblical polity, it is a difficult thing to do. You either go into some sort of stagnation sometimes, where you maintain what we might say is a good Baptist biblical polity, but you're not very evangelistic. Yeah. Or you become evangelistic, and then you might see in retrospect that some of the changes that we did to maybe meet current needs undermined a biblical or Baptist polity. So it's a difficult tension, but it's something we see again and again for sure.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to consider how wonderful it is to plant churches. That's a good thing. But it requires to be that we think through it very carefully and biblically, and that we have to do polity and ecclesiology. It can't be driven by pragmatism. And I think the importance of having good guardrails by the Bible, by confessional associational standards, is what prevents us from becoming susceptible to pragmatism, because I think our form of polity is the easiest to become dominated by pragmatism.
Yeah,
because we are wanting to empower an individual congregation, and we do believe that every person in the church is equal and has a role and a place to serve. But if you're not careful, you can become so driven by emotions that you just start doing things to make something happen or work. And I just wonder, I think about in Mississippi, for example, you know, the first Baptist that came there in 1791 that settled around Natchez came from the Charleston area. By 1806, so in less than 20 years, there were six churches, Baptist churches in Mississippi, and they formed an association. Now, they were kind of scattered, but they saw that early. But I would say that's because they were influenced by the Charleston tradition in many ways. And that gets lost. To me, in the South, I feel like it's preserved longer because of the dominating Charleston tradition on these things. Whereas up north, it kind of fades faster, because I think the Philadelphia's influence, while very strong for a long time, begins to dwindle. And maybe it's just because of culture too. You know, it lessens as you move into Illinois and Ohio and Kentucky, than say as they planted churches in Texas. Because I mean, Texas, you know, it's a wild place, but there's very early on in Baptist life a very strong associational component there, and in Arkansas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so you can have hyper individualism at kind of a local congregational level, with individuals. Of course, you can also have a sort of hyper individualism as at a local church level where churches aren't associating with other churches. So there isn't this mutual accountability. I was thinking about, as you were talking about church planting a moment ago, there's a really a recent book on church planting from Nine Marks called Planting by Pastoring. And I read the book and I thought, this isn't like any other church planting book I've ever read. At the end, there was like a model for a covenanting service. If you wanted to kind of use this covenanting service model. And I was just thinking, what church planting book has an appendix on a covenanting service? But one of the things that the author of that book argues for, and I've kind of been mulling this over, and I think this is right, is you need to have a relationship, not just with like a denominational entity. You don't need to just be sent out by a denominational entity to plant a church. This author was emphasizing the importance of having an identifiable relationship with a congregation that is sending you out and is holding you accountable, so that there's even this kind of local church interdependency, even with a church that's kind of you're having to give an account back to. So hopefully you would eventually come an association. Let's say you were moving to a different place and there were other churches over time, but there's a sort of local church accountability, not because you're sent out by, you know, the SBC's church planting arm or the National Association of Real Baptist Church Planting Arm by yourself, but that you're sent out by an actual local congregation that you're accountable to. I think that's a way of accomplishing kind of what we're talking about as well as we're thinking about church planting.
Yeah. Now I want to read this next statement. And this is a little bit long, but I think it's very good from Winthrop Hudson. He then talks about outward changes that happen in Baptist life. And so listen to this very carefully. Associational life was allowed slowly to decay, and no vigorous associational life was permitted to develop beyond narrow geographical limits. The larger relationship of the churches to each other was improvised on frankly utilitarian grounds and was then defended on the basis that the Great Commission was spoken to individuals and not to churches. Apart from this, the pattern of local church life remained largely unchanged, and it persisted partly by habit and partly by continuing conviction that it had been prescribed in the scriptures. Now, here's what's interesting, this next line. And think about Northern Baptist context. When the authority of the Bible in a literalistic and legalistic sense was brought into question, however, the whole structure toppled almost overnight. Discipline was relaxed. The covenant fell into disuse. The pastoral office was obscured. The deacons were shunted to one side while boards and committees proliferated. Admission procedures and baptismal practices became lax and indiscriminate. The guarding of the integrity of the Lord's table was forgotten. The covenant meeting was discarded, and the church meeting frayed out in preoccupation with trivialities. The older conception of covenanting with the Lord and with one another to walk together in all the ways of obedience which he prescribeth, which had been partially replaced by the notion of the church as a purely evangelistic center, was not to give way to an understanding of the church, which was defined almost completely in instrumental terms. For some, with the discarding of the older elements of church order, the church became merely a missionary society. For others, the church became a social agency, which had to demonstrate its utility by the services it rendered.
Yeah.
Now I think that's a very powerful assessment.
And that really gets at what we were saying earlier about ecclesiology as it relates to missions and the Great Commission. There has absolutely been a transformation in Baptist life about how we understand the primary purpose and function of the church. And so as you think about in the 17th century, did people think that you should evangelize and that believers in churches should be trying to share the gospel with other people and you know, see people saved? No doubt. They believe that. But the idea of a covenanted community as kind of the primary concept of a Baptist church, You see it as early as John Smith. But that idea of a covenanted community and trying to sort of maintain the purity of the church, which included membership and discipline, to moving towards the church as just kind of being like a mini missions agency or something like that. That is a significant transformation. You know, I was thinking about as you were reading that, the influence of ideas about kind of pure democracy on the life of the church in a Baptist church, what you end up with then is an elimination of accountability, right? So there's you downplay discipline because you have the emphasis of the individual, and we've seen this traced out in a variety of places. Wills's democratic religion is like a microcosm of this big thing, the elimination of accountability with membership and discipline. So again, a de-emphasis on a covenanted community and the purity of the church. You have a de-emphasis on any sort of hierarchy in the church. Obviously, we Baptists have always emphasized the priesthood of the believer, of all believers. And so we don't think that pastors or elders are somehow more holy than others. But there you almost lose all sort of pastoral leadership or shepherding altogether because you're so trying to emphasize the priesthood of all believers, maybe in a way that accords with these democratic principles that undermines the leadership or shepherding role of the minister. And then you have a de-emphasis on or maybe even an elimination of something like exclusion, whether we're talking about excommunication from the life of the church or whether we're talking about how we fence the table at the Lord's Supper. So all of these are significant influences on the life of the church when we move from seeing the local body as a covenanted body or community of believers who are trying to maintain the purity of the gospel and the purity of the congregation to being a mini evangelistic agency. That is a radical shift in how we understand the nature of the church. And we're still kind of seeing the fruit of that. But again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about kind of the church being this difficult tension between maintaining biblical polity and evangelism, missions. It's a tough thing to maintain.
Yeah, and I think it goes then too, you lose the importance also that as a church is accountable to other churches. That we're walking together with other bodies of believers, that we can't make another church do anything, but we can say there is an integrity that is a part of a voluntary association. And I think that in our current context, and I think it's more in Southern Baptist life probably than in your context, but I'm sure you've got a dimension of this too. As I think about if we were to go back to Baptists in the 17th and 18th century, they would have understood that the most important meetings for them to go to, apart from obviously the local church meetings, but their local associations meetings would have trumped any kind of national gathering. Well, today, there are many people who will go to a national annual meeting who have no care or concern at all for like their local association. And in a way, we've imitated the political context of our country. People will not even care about their local elections, but they're going to fight you over who they'll vote for president. Well, yeah. Your local officials make policy that impacts you a lot more than, I mean, the House representative doesn't do anything. They work, you know, 2 days for every 2 months or something, and they name post offices. That's about the extent we have with the current Congress. Not to go down that rabbit hole, but you know, we've lost that, and especially as Baptists, our sense of what this means in covenanting and working together is that we know each other and it's local, and that's where to me the notion of like Leland and really that Jeffersonian democracy makes its way then to when we get to the end of the 19th century, we move into the 20th century, and how liberty of conscience gets redefined under sole competency. And this is the last thing I want us to talk about for just a moment, is then Hudson talks about, in his estimation, where soul competency really affects the churches in a bad way. He talks about Alva Hovey, who was a Northern Baptist theologian who, you know, kind of was rolling with this. And then E.Y. Mullins, who in Southern Baptist life was really the proprietor of soul competency. I mean, Mullins is the one who said that it was the constitutive principle of Baptist church life. Now, then Hudson says this: to the extent that Baptists were to develop an apologetic for their church life during the early decades of the 20th century, it was to be on the basis of this highly individualistic principle. It has become increasingly apparent that this principle was derived from the general cultural and religious climate of the 19th century rather than any serious study of the Bible. That's a mic drop. But it was its inadequacy as a basis for church life rather than its point of origin that constituted a major problem for Baptists. Not only did it fail to provide detailed guidance for questions of church order beyond such generalized corollary axioms as all believers have a right to interpret the Bible for themselves and all believers have a right to equal privileges in the church, but also it served to dissolve any real concept of the church, for it interpreted the faith as a one-to-one relationship between God and the individual. And then maybe the statement that Winthrop Hudson is most famous for, the following: the practical effect of the stress upon soul competency as the cardinal doctrine of Baptists was to make every man's hat his own church. And what I thought in listening and thinking about that is it turns every church into a collection of islands. That every member is an island unto themselves, essentially.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of a collection of islands that have almost maybe formed a confederacy, some kind of alliance that we meet in this place to do things. But it's almost like I can interpret the Bible myself, and my interpretation is just as valid as yours. And I think while there's on one hand in Baptist life, we embrace that because it allowed us to say every person has the ability to interpret the scripture for themselves. The state can't tell us, the state church. Now, on the other hand, though, it then opened the gateway for any kind of heresy to become acceptable in church life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this is something we've talked about again and again, but what's lost in all of this is for all of the things that we said about religious liberty and religious toleration and the relationship of the state and the church and the church to the state, those things are not true within the life of the church. Yeah. We are to be a covenanted body who are governed by a confession of faith. And yes, it is a voluntary association. And because of that, and as a result of that, then we act in accordance with our confessional documents, with our confessional statements, and with our church covenants. So to take these ideas that are applicable to the relationship between the church and the state and then to try to move them over into the life of the church is really insanity. And it loses the sort of basic idea that Baptists are and have been a confessional people who are governed by a confession. This kind of radical individualism, though, where you're saying every person is kind of an island unto themselves, I think the natural conclusion of that is then why the church at all, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's ultimately where it's gone. You know, I have 18 to 22-year-olds in the classroom all the time, and I have a section of systematic theology where we talk about Baptist polity, and I feel like I have to spend half a class or more every time I teach the class, convincing them that the church actually matters, that they need an identifiable relationship with the church, and that kind of this idea that I can have a relationship with Jesus without having a relationship with a local body is not a biblical concept. But I do think that's the natural conclusion of this. Then mm-hmm. why the church at all? Why even bother? That's just kind of unnecessarily messy and complex.
Becomes basically the only reason to do so is purely out of tradition or a social concept. And I think we've seen, you know, that's declined more and more in our culture when you're in a place where you're post-Christian or even a sense of nominal cultural Christianity is no longer in vogue in society, then it just leaves people to even, you know, be less and less. I think for us, what I would encourage our audience, all of us, is that, you know, there's a lot that gets called Baptist that I think is more American or cultural than we may realize. And I think there's a tradition, we could call it the London, Philadelphia, Charleston tradition, that was confessional associationalism that really prioritized relationships within the local church and then among local churches together. And I think also a word, and I know it may stir the pot a little bit, but I think there's a lot of people, and I'm using the terms the left and the right in quotation marks, because, you know, I think they're political terms that get brought into theological life, but let's just
stir that pot, Jake, stir the pot.
You know, soul competency gets thrown on the left all the time. And it's true that a lot of liberals in Baptist life in the 20th century use soul competency as a shield to reinterpret the Baptist vision. I think there's a lot of people on the right today, maybe we want to call it the more populistic right, that are doing the same thing. They are using a form of soul competency to reinterpret the Baptist vision into their own cultural mandate. And I think that this is where robust confessionalism is a protection for churches, associations, and institutions against the whims of a left or right tribe that may rule the day. And say, no, it's not about whatever feels good or is popular at the moment, that we have a consensus. And I think that consensus is expressed to us in these confessional documents. And I think any time, and I've seen this recently, but it is a stark reminder of the mindset of some people that when you can quote a Baptist confession based on scripture and say, this is where we are, and then by quoting that, you get called woke, squish, moderate, lib, whatever, you know, this is insanity. This is absolutely insanity. You know, I'm sorry, but an associationally agreed upon confession of faith trumps your tweets and your whims and your whatever. And I need to hear that too. All of us need to be on guard of how easily our definition of what something is could be more political, cultural in the moment than what is actually the confessional consensus. So,
hey, I couldn't have said it better for myself. And, you know, in fact, as you were speaking, I was thinking, I need to create a Baptist think tank entity and put you over it. I mean, you've got it. You've got it, man.
Hey, I created the Kiffin Room. And I've got 6 followers in there, but we've grown from just 3. So, you know, hey, what can I say? No.
Yeah.
I think again, that's where we're always looking for something more than the church. And I think of all people, especially as Baptists, and this may be where my landmarker is coming out of me. But I think we too often devalue how precious the local church really is.
Mm. So. Yeah.
Amen. All right. Well, I hope this has been helpful. We kind of just, you know, this was we were talking shop today. And Lord willing, our next episode, we'll resume our Baptist bios. We're going to make our way for a little while across the Atlantic to America and talk about Roger Williams. We might even debate, is he even a Baptist or not? So until then, stay Baptist, my friends.
Stay Baptist.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.